Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Environmental law professor Oliver Houck spends much of his free time wandering the Mississippi River Badger, that no man's land between the levee and the river. On this week's show, Oliver takes us on a Badger adventure like no other. Oliver gathers dewberries there, and if you're game, I'll share some recipe ideas about how to use them. Then, Dr. Tim Harlan, medical director at Tulane University School of Medicine, shares progress on the culinary education program that's quickly becoming a popular part of the rotation for Tulane's med students. Get ready for a lovely meander on this week's Louisiana Eats. When Oliver Houck isn't teaching environmental law at Tulane, he can often be found with his faithful dog, Miss Bear, wandering the no man's land of the Mississippi River Badger. Oliver gathered together reflections on his Badger experiences in his book, Down on the Badger. Oliver, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thanks so much, Bobby, for inviting me.
First, for the uninitiated, please explain what the Badger is.
The Badger is the place, as the French say, that the water beats against the land, which is why it's called the Badger. And it's that nondescript piece of terrain between the top of the levee and wherever the Mississippi River happens to be at the moment. So in the spring, there's virtually no Badger. The water's right up to the base of the levee. But folks are fishing for catfish, and they're in there making rafts, and they're doing Tom Sawyer stuff, and it's a marvelous ceremony.
How did your fascination with this special spot begin?
Well, you know, the river brought me to Louisiana long, long ago. I first came down in 1971 on a piece of the river called the Atchafalaya to the west of here. And the Corps of Engineers had its eyes on the Atchafalaya, and others wanted to save it for the beautiful swamp, crawfish heaven, duck heaven, fish heaven that it was. I mean, that swamp to the west of us is five times as productive as the Everglades in fish and wildlife. It's a factory. And it was going to be dried out and put into soybeans, so I was asked to come in and see whether I could change people's mind. So that was tied at the hip to the Mississippi, because the Atchafalaya is where the Mississippi is going to be thrown during high flood time. In fact, the Atchafalaya floodway saved our rear ends here just 2 years ago in that big high water event. If that Atchafalaya floodway hadn't been there, we'd have been in serious trouble. So I came down to work on that project, and that brought me to the river. And 17 years later, we finally solved it. Meanwhile, I had moved down with my family, my two boys and my wife and my dog, and started teaching at Tulane. So it was natural I'd go up and wander the river and wander the Badger. But nobody knows about the Badger because there's so few people up there. It's just this wonderful no-man's land that runs basically from the Corps of Engineers upriver as far as you want to go. It'll go as far as Vicksburg.
You also write about mythical, almost extinct creatures that you believe may still inhabit the Badger area. Would you tell us about the ivory-billed woodpecker?
Well, I can't claim that the ivory-billed would be there because the Badger has been too human-occupied for it to last. It's a deep wood species, but it was the iconic species of Louisiana. We think it's the pelican. We think it's the this. No, there are a lot of pelicans. There are a lot of other birds. The ivory-billed woodpecker was the king of the birds of the world. It was the size of a German shepherd. It had wingspan like a vulture. It had a red head like a a cardinal from Rome. great peaked red cap, a shiny white ivory bill, and an almost prehistoric flight, jerky and almost mechanical. And it inhabited old, old trees, basically cypress, tupelo gum. And those forests, of course, were our trademark. We were the cypress forest of the world. And we started logging out those forests, and they started going down in droves. And the last live ivory bills were known and spotted and confirmed in the late 30s up north of the Atchafalaya Swamp. The thing that drew me to the Atchafalaya in 1971 was a report of an ivory bill. And I told Charlie Bosch, who brought me down, Charlie, if you have an ivory bill in there, we've saved the swamp. We never did find it. But
we can hope.
But we can hope. And a more recent report came out of the Pearl. They played a recording of what they heard, and I swear to God, I've heard that. So I live with this kind of snag tooth, whatever these monsters are, Loch Ness kind of impression of those woods. But here's the thing about the badger that is important and not mythical. If you were on the badger over the levee, you're away from the highway sounds. You have the river sounds coming, but they are ancient river sounds. They're boats going by, and they go back millennia. And although you're 100 yards away from people, I mean, they're riding by in the levee top. You could throw a stone and hit them. You are as mentally away and as aesthetically away as if you were in the North Pole, as if you were in the jungle. There's this wonderful awareness, awayness. That has a profound effect on people.
Well, along with, you know, the mythical creatures that we've mentioned, there's a large number of very ordinary animals, too. And
yeah.
I guess rabbits are certainly part of that. And really, Oliver, I have to tell you, I'm still haunted by your description of the unusual rabbit hunting activities you've observed.
Yeah.
Now, what's up with that?
There are a lot of wild animals in there. There are wild pig. There are coyote. There are all manner of hawks and owls. But the most common are the rabbits. And they tend to sortie out of the shelter of those woods to feed at the wood's edges and to go over the levee and go into gardens on the far side. Then they retreat back. So I was biking up one evening, and you also need to know this was at spring high water, so there was very little dry land between the levee and the river. And there were just a few pieces of dry land with brambles on it, and that's where the rabbits would be, and that's where the people were. There were four of them. They came bursting out of the woods below me, the men brandishing golf clubs and chasing a rabbit who was looked like a pregnant mother. She was heavy.
Oh, dear.
The belly was heavy, and she lumbered up the levee in front of my bike and then down the other side, the men in hot pursuit. And I just put my bike between them as if I were surprised, and I was surprised. And I stopped, and I said, "What's up?" And the guy said, "Hunting rabbits." And his eyes were just wild with sort of joy. And, you know, as you are now, I was shocked. And I dawdled there to give that rabbit time to get away. But I could see on the levee top pieces of fur and other things. This wasn't the only rabbit they had been after.
And they do it with a golf club.
They did, which I thought was kind of wonderful. Because, I mean, if you go back to the roots of human beings, that's the way we killed rabbits, right?
Well, Oliver,
we clubbed them.
Do you think maybe they're at least eating these rabbits?
Oh, absolutely, they're eating them.
Oh, well, thank God. Okay,
no,
that
no,
makes
I think
it all better.
Well, it makes it some better. But here's what occurred to me, and this is what I muse about. Why was I shocked? What was I? Was it the fact of a golf? Suppose they had been hunting him with a bow and arrow.
Uh-huh.
Suppose they've been hunting them with a gun. Would I have felt as shocked, offended? Wow, we've taken a big step backward, you know, was the first step thought in my mind. But no. And so the fun part of this story and all the stories in here is not just what happened, but What does it sort of mean? What does it mean to find beautiful art that no one will ever see, that people are busy creating down in this scraggly piece of woods? What does that mean? And what does it mean to have people hunting rabbits in this way? And is there something nice about people being free to be able to do it?
We're coming right back with more tales from the Mississippi River Batcher from environmentalist and author Oliver Houck. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Oliver Houck's passion for dewberries gathered on the Batcher is only matched by his love for loquats. As our conversation with Oliver continues, he shares the stories of his experiments with the native wild Louisiana fruit. Another one of your great food obsessions are loquats.
Yeah. The loquats are a jam of their own, and they were, I guess, the first thing I started canning. And I got into it because when we moved into our neighborhood near the levee, local boys would come by with sticks, and they'd be knocking fruits out of trees and picking them up and eating them from the sidewalk. By the way, Poppy, I haven't seen that happen in the last 15 years. But when I moved here 25 years ago, 30 years ago, I moved here in, wow, 81. How many years that is? They were doing it.
It was an after-school activity, yeah. I think, for everybody.
They were doing it.
We called them Japanese plums,
yep,
though.
They do that, too.
And everybody knew where the Japanese plum trees were on the way home from school because they were a perfect after-school
snack. Me too. And they tended to be easy because they're in the tree box space. They tend to be located between the sidewalk and the street. If they're inside a yard, a lot of householders think that they're nuisances because they drop this fruit. And the seeds. So Lisa and I caught on to just taking the fruit, and then I thought of canning them because my mother used to can a lot, and I'd lick the nets, you know, when you strain the little strainers and that, and I'd be hanging around the kitchen for tastes. And so the loquat became our first canning fruit because they were neighborhood fruit and easy to find, but in order to reach them high in the tree and get a good number of them, you'd have to get up high. So we'd park the car under a loquat tree and stand on the roof of the car and reach up and pull them down the branches and shake the fruit down. And I got a little lopper, and I would lop them, and Lisa would catch them with a fishing net. It was a pretty bizarre operation. It looked like homeless people were attacking your trees. And so...
Well. Let's move on to the dewberries, could we?
Sure.
Because this is something else I know you're a great lover of. And honestly, Oliver, I'd never heard of dewberries until you introduced me to them. So would you tell us about the Batcher character who introduced you to dewberries?
Yeah, he did it indirectly. He was gathering mulberries and probably another thing that's gone out, but... This was a fellow who camped on the levee under a shelter, and he worked at a hardware store on Oak Street. So I knew who he was, and he was picking the mulberries, and he said he'd made wine out of them. So I took a few, and it popped into my mouth. I don't know whether you have tasted mulberries, but they're not succulent. They have a taste, but it's a little like eating a dried fruit. And I said, that's a little bitter, Sam. And then he said... Well, you ought to try the dewberries. Well, I hadn't heard of dewberries any more than I heard of Merlotons. And they come in later. The mulberry come out in February, and the dewberries will come out in March. And they look like a blackberry. They look like a raspberry. But they're 10 times as sweet. They're often larger.
What color are they?
Oh, they're a deep purple when they're ripe. They go from... green to red, which is in nature, red's kind of a warning sign. You just don't eat red things. And then it moves on to purple. So the trick with the loquat is not picking them. They fall off the trees. It's pitting them. The trick with the dewberries is a little more fundamental. It's the picking them.
Yes.
Because they're thorn bushes.
Oh.
And inside those thorn bushes, they seem to have this symbiosis with poison ivy. They attract each other.
Oh, dear.
So poison ivy will be up in there. Also, little critters will be up in there. There'll be anole. There may be some little snakes. There may be, you know, you'll kick up some rabbits. You know, you're out in the briar patch.
Of course, since we're talking about being on the water, there's a lot of seafood to be caught from the Badger. And you've seen a lot of catfishing going on there, right?
Yeah, there is a lot of fishing on the Badger. And it's a little scary because the Mississippi contamination can be pretty high. And you never know because there are these what they call excursions from the industries upstream, and you don't know what's swirling down. If you took a grab sample of the river on any given day, it might be perfectly good. It would just be sediment-filled, muddy water. But, boy, those industrial discharges are powerful. If you go right below the big refineries, Exxon, Shell, you're going to have some pretty dramatic bumps. And so that's where people fish.
Wow. And
basically, these are poor people, often African-American. And they're bringing these whoppers out of the water, and they're taking them home. I mean, it's like taking home a knapsack.
One of the things you pointed out that I don't know that a lot of people realize is what goes into skinning a catfish.
Well, it's amazing, and I've watched them do it, although mostly they do it at home. They'll take the whole fish home. It's easier. But there is this fellow who fishes right under the power lines by Ochsner. And one high water evening, I came down, and he was wrestling a fish out of the water. It was the most amazing experience. He had a fish in so big that if he tried to pull it out of the water on his hook and line, he would have broken the line or ripped the hook out of its mouth. It was like a buffalo in the water. He slid into the water like one of these aqua swimmer mermaids, and he just oozed his way over to the fish and started stroking it and calming it. And within minutes, he had that fish absolutely calm, nuzzling him like a puppy.
Wow.
And then he slowly slipped his hand in behind the gills of the fish until his hand was literally inside the fish's throat. Still soothing the fish, the fish is still alive, sort of looking at him. And then with that grip, he could, standing in the water, he's about waist deep at that point, standing in the water, he begins hauling this monster out of the water. And when he finished, he had a very large fish out. There was a log there, and he had a hammer and a nail, and he nailed the fish to the log so that it hung down, and he slid it, and he began skinning it the way you would take off a pair of tight nylons or, you know, a wetsuit. And he just slid it down each side and pulled and pulled and pulled. It's the way I imagine young girls must get out of their jeans these days. I have no idea how they do it otherwise. But he completely turned that skin inside out, leaving the catfish there, and then he gutted it and took home the meat.
A lot of Badger residents are living a pretty upscale, genteel life there for the most part.
Yeah, it's changed. There's an upscaleness to the Badger, the way there's an upscaleness to habitations along rivers all over America. America's rediscovering the rivers. You know, Baltimore Harbor, New York Harbor. When you look at where the real estate is, Seattle, you know, the waterfront is in. And so for millennia, certainly for hundreds of years, the Badger was the place where the lowest lives went to live their low lives, right?
Mm-hmm.
Scumbags, ruffians, castoffs, outlaws, hand-to-mouthers, violence, probably a lot of fun, but also pretty high risk. and certainly low rent. New Orleans did it New Orleans style for a very long time between the Civil War and going through the Great Depression. There was a proliferation of these little houses along the river, and they were, unlike the real rough riversides of other areas, these were more genteel. These were people who worked in town. Kids went to school. Captain Bisso of Bisso Marine had his place there. Mm-hmm. There was a church up there. There were also people who were flat crazy. There was a priest who wore a sheet and would try to baptize you in the river if he caught you. And so there were... But those houses were all taken down when they improved, raised the levee after the big 36 floods. And that was a trauma. Getting these people, that was a trauma. But there are 13 left.
And how
and they're
does
just
one...
upstream of the Jefferson Parish line. And those 13 have gone from fishing camp shack to sort of uptown well-to-do in maybe the past 10 years.
How does one acquire one of these properties?
One knows someone.
Ah, that's the bottom line.
And then one plays with the zoning and the building codes, because the ostensible code is that you have to build within the footprint of the original house, and the little houses were tidy. And what you're seeing up there now is, you know, 10 times that and three stories in the air.
Pretty but fancy. I like to go up fancy. There and look myself.
Yep.
Well, I want to thank you so much for taking us on this journey along the Badger.
It's such an unknown place to us, and it's so rich. I've loved being there, and I like being on your show as well. Thanks.
Well, this was a delicious tour, so thank you.
My pleasure.
That was Tulane Law Professor and author Oliver Hawk, down on the Badger. Although Oliver Hawk has been working with his Dewberry and Loquat preserve recipe for the past 10 years, he advised me that no year is exactly the same, so this really isn't an exacting science. Dewberry preparation is easy because in order not to wash away any of their good flavor, Oliver trusts that the high cooking temperatures will take care of any mist of poison ivy or a little bug that may have come along from the Badger. The loquats are a different matter because they require pitting, which he accomplishes by slitting the fruit, then squeezing out those smooth, shiny brown pits. Oliver combines a total of 3 quarts of dewberry and loquat fruit with the juice of 2 lemons, 1/2 cup of sugar, and 1.5 cups of pectin. He brings the fruit mixture to a full rolling boil. Then, because he savors a tart flavor in the preserves, he judiciously stirs in just 1.5 additional cups of sugar. Once the preserves return to a boil, he carefully allows it to cook for just 1 minute more before removing it from the heat and proceeding with the traditional canning process using sterilized glass jars and lids. Once he hears the lid pop, indicating he's gotten a tight, safe seal on the jar of preserves, Oliver delights in displaying his handiwork on a shelf, where he enjoys the stained glass-like effect of light through the fruit all year long. For Oliver's very own recipe for dewberry and loquat preserves, visit our Louisiana Eats website at wwno.org. I'm Poppy Tooker, and Oliver Hawk's Badger Gathered Fruit Preserves are real Louisiana eats. I met Suzanne Nelson of Cozy Farms recently at Terra Vita, an annual food and wine event in North Carolina's Research Triangle. Luckily, I was able to capture the young farmer and her boundless energy for a Louisiana Eats conversation. Suzanne, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, let's start at the beginning. You didn't set out in life to be a farmer, did you?
No, and my dear mother is still asking what I'm going to do with my English degree. I spent the better part of a decade in Washington, D.C. as a reporter. I covered politics and money in politics and how Congress interacts with the executive branch. I never imagined that I would care so much about food. But it started with some things that happened in the health of my husband and my dog, actually, that I started learning about what was in kibble. And then when I learned what was in kibble, it wasn't a whole lot different from processed human foods. And so I started caring about food. And the more I cared about food, you know, my investigative reporter sense started really looking at food, and I didn't want to eat it anymore. I didn't even necessarily want to eat what was at the posh grocery store. I wanted to go out and eat things from people that were growing things in the dirt. And I set out, the farmer part of me set out because I wanted two things that I couldn't find. I wanted milk from my very own cow and eggs from chickens, and I wanted them to eat real food too. So that's where we started.
Let's go back to this whole feed thing, because when you started trying to find feed for your animals, that really was a kind of far out and super expensive thing that you were doing. Elaborate on that for me.
Pigs and chickens are omnivores, and in the absence of having enough food to scavenge, in nature they would find mice, they would find grubs, they would find other things of sources of protein. In addition to the pasture and things. In the absence of having a sufficient quantity of that, they need to eat some protein and energy that's supplemented. And so that, in the United States, comes in the form of grain. But I didn't want to feed them amalgamated, extruded, genetically modified, Roundup-ready soybeans and corn. That was not the point of me doing all this. At the end of the day, you can ask a chicken to go out on pasture, you can give her fresh grass every day, and 90% of what that hen puts in her mouth, nutritionally speaking, is what comes out of that feed trough. So what's in the feed matters a lot. Don't get me wrong, the pasture matters a lot too, but the feed matters. So I started going to our local co-op and buying wheat and buying corn, and I ground it in my home flour mill, and it didn't work very well. And then I met a guy named George Teague, I went up there one day to buy some minerals for my cow, and he said, well, that's silly. I have a mill. I could mill you some feed. So in the beginning, I would mix all the supplements, the herbs, the vitamins, the minerals, the probiotics. I would mix them in a little bin in my driveway in a Rubbermaid tote, and I'd hand mix them, and then I'd bring them up, and he mixed the grains, and we would bag it in his driveway, and feed would spill everywhere, and it was an ordeal. But now he's gotten some grants, and he has a large mill, and he's a regional organic feed supplier, and it's excellent feed. And when my daughter sticks her hand in that feed trough and tries some, it doesn't freak me out. It's real food.
Now, let's talk about the old Jerseys who no longer have a purpose at the dairy cheese farm where they've been living.
Well, we have a partnership with a wonderful, wonderful cheesemakers, Portia McKnight and Flo Holly of Chapel Hill Creamery. We wanted cows, and they didn't have cows for sale. But I knew their older cows, who had some troubles, they weren't perfect anymore because they're getting on in years. I knew that they were better for me to start with than some younger animals from less desirable stock. And so we've kind of adopted a bunch of their cows. I mean, these cows are 9, 10. I mean, that's old for a dairy cow. And in conventional U.S. agriculture, those dairy cows only last until they're 3, and then they're Hardee's hamburgers. So we have a bunch of them, and we're trying to get babies out of them. And the other thing that we're doing with Portia and Flo is we're buying their bull calves and grafting them, as it's known, on mamas. So Jerseys, so milk cows, have more milk than their baby can drink. It's one of the anomalies, if you will, about what we've kind of bred cows to be. One of the things that a pasture-based system allows you is a little bit more freedom to do some interesting, innovative things. And so I'm not the first to do this, but one of the things we're doing is raising rose veal out of those bull calves.
I don't know that our listeners are necessarily familiar with rose veal. Explain what that is.
So veal has gotten a deservedly bad reputation in the United States because the animals, when they were not hit over the head or drowned in the river, they were put in teeny crates. They were not allowed to turn around. They were never allowed to eat anything but milk replacer. So a cow's rumen, a bovine's rumen, needs fiber. They need forage in order to be normal. these little babies were given an all-liquid diet to keep their meat very, very pale. I mean, their meat looks like chicken. I mean, it's not beef in any real sense, but that was what was desired from a culinary point of view. Our bull calves, I think, have the best life of any animal on our farm. They are either born on our farm or born in Chapel Hill Creamery. They come, they get either their own mother's milk or an adopted mother's milk, and they drink all the milk they want to drink. They frolic with their mothers in the pasture. They eat all the hay they want to eat. They get moved to fresh grass twice a day. They're not castrated. They're not dehorned. They're not weaned. They have all the good things in life and none of the bad things of being a farm animal. And we harvest them about 7 months at about 550 pounds. So they're big boys by then. I mean, they're not babies. They have thick necks, and they look like young men. And they start acting like young men, too. And their meat is really unbelievable. It's extremely tender beef. It looks like beef. It doesn't look like veal. It's rose in hue. It hadn't had the time to develop into a true, really deep red. It's more of a rosy red. It's extremely forgiving to cook. You really can't make it tough. You can't overcook it. I mean, I don't recommend overcooking it, but it's just extremely forgiving. And it has a milk finish. You can taste the milk, and it makes the meat have kind of a creamy finish. And it's the best meat I've ever had.
Suzanne, what's it like to drink the milk straight from the cows?
It's like drinking ice cream. There's just a wholeness there. So there's a lot of things that the milk industry doesn't want you to know about milk. The first is that even if you go to the store and buy something labeled whole milk, it ain't whole. So the cream has been skimmed, and it's been sold for high-value items like butter and ice cream. And they don't have to put this on the label, but if you go way deep in U.S. code, you can find where this is permissible. They can add non-fat milk powder back to the milk. So the whole milk has had some cream removed, some cream added back, and the mouthfeel that you want from the cream, that's what gives it that thick, lovely, creamy taste, is non-fat milk powder from China in many cases with all sorts of other things in it, perhaps, that don't belong in it. So when you drink milk straight from the cow, it doesn't even taste the same. The way it feels in your mouth isn't the same. So that's what we feed to our own family.
So we've talked about the animals, and we've talked about how this all came to be. Part of the equation that you were working on that seems to be working out for you is how you actually sell your products from the farm. Let's talk about the relationship you have with that very, very special business in North Carolina.
So we're proud to be partners with the Saks Baja General Store. They buy a lot of our meat and eggs and put it on their menu, and we also retail a lot of meat through their case. So I buy feed from George Teague at Reedy Fork Farms. I feed it to my animals. One of the animals that we raise on that feed are broiler chickens, meat chickens. I turn and process those chickens and sell them to the Saks Baja General Store. They pay me. I turn around and pay George. And so all of a sudden we have community, and we have people who are able to create something that individually we wouldn't be able to create.
And they're cooking and serving some of that delicious food there too.
Oh, well, and that's just tremendous. So the Saks Baja General Store bills themselves as a 5-star gas station. It's a rather unique dining experience. I mean, what Jeff Barney has been able to do, not only with cooking his own food, but in training young people to also cook in these methods. And he uses very traditional methods. I mean, he, you know, in many ways, old school in a wonderful way. Braising, I mean, his braising is fairly much what he's known for. And I often say that the general store has made our farm possible, and people often think that I mean that they've bought our food, which of course they do in some quantity. But really the reason why it's possible is because they fed the farmer. I don't have much time in the kitchen anymore. I've been known many, many a days to eat 3 meals a day at the general store. So they truly feed me and nourish me, and that makes our farm possible.
Suzanne, I am so thrilled that you happen to marry a guy from Louisiana. So hopefully that will bring you back to visit with us again on Louisiana Eats.
Absolutely. I'd love to come back. Thanks for having me, Poppy.
Suzanne Nelson of North Carolina's Cozy Farm. Next week.
we get an update from Tulane Medical Director Tim Harlan on the progress of a culinary education program designed to give medical students a taste of the good medicine that good food can be. Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Louisiana Eats culinary heritage heroes are farmers, fishers, chefs, and food producers who bring an authentic taste of our state's heritage to the world's tables. This week's culinary heritage hero is a native New Orleanian who worked as a purchasing agent for Wembley Ties before he and his brother decided to buy a dilapidated French Quarter building and restaurant in 1982. Despite the fact that he'd never worked in a restaurant before, nor had even eaten at this particular historic institution, our culinary heritage hero found himself under the spell of its venerable tradition. You see, the building, located on the corner of Madison and Decatur Streets, just across the street from the original Old French Market, had been known as Dutre's Coffee Exchange in pre-Civil War New Orleans. When the original proprietor passed away, his wife, Elizabeth, married the bartender, Hippolyte Begay, and by 1880, the establishment's name had changed to Begay's. Soon it became New Orleans' most celebrated restaurant, the place where every tourist wanted to dine. The great Creole cuisinier, Madame Begay, died in 1906, and by 1914, the restaurant became known as Two Jacks, the classic New Orleans restaurant previously located up the street from Begay's. Our hero made sure that the restaurant's classic dishes like shrimp remoulade, boiled beef brisket with horseradish, and thick black coffee served in shot glasses were as authentic in taste as the dining rooms in which they were served. Through meticulous research, our culinary heritage hero restored the restaurant and bar with such care that Madame Begay herself would have felt at home there. In fact, the restaurant and its history became our hero's life's work, where he could always be found presiding over the bustling operation, showing off the many artifacts related to both Begay's and Two Jacks that he prominently displayed for all to enjoy. Because of his hospitality and careful preservation of a New Orleans culinary landmark, Stephen Ladder is this week's Louisiana Eats Culinary Heritage Hero, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen. Sadly, Two Jacks' 21st century proprietor Stephen Ladder passed away in his sleep on February 18th, earlier this year. All of us at WWNO join me in expressing our condolences to the Ladder family and everyone at Two Jacks Restaurant, where because of Stephen Ladder's legacy, you can always find the very best Louisiana eats. Exciting time to be a student at Tulane University's School of Medicine. Through a visionary collaboration with Johnson & Wales Culinary School, Tulane's medical students are having hands-on lessons in the good medicine of good nutrition. Here to catch us up on the new program's progress is the university's medical director, Tim Harlan, our Louisiana Eats friend, Dr. Gourmet. Welcome back, Tim.
It is great to be with you, Poppy.
So for our listeners who may have missed part one of the launch of this collaboration between Johnson & Wales and Tulane's Med School, Give us a bit of the backstory.
Well, about 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, my dean came to me, Ben Sachs, and said that he wanted to create a teaching kitchen to teach medical students how to cook, which seems like a fantastic idea. And it's not an idea that is really sustainable, you know, inside the medical school. You can do that, but it takes a lot of effort. Building a teaching kitchen's not cheap, as you might expect. And our decision that really drove this home was to put that teaching kitchen out in the community. And we are still, as you know, as I've talked to you, in negotiations on signing a lease, but we think we're very close to finding a space for that teaching kitchen in the community. Now, the cool part of that is that in the interim, we've been able to use a kitchen in the Murphy Building, one of the buildings on the downtown medical school campus, to go on and start teaching our medical students how to cook. So we've not been idle since we talked about this last.
So what is that, a big commercial kitchen that's in?
This was a warming kitchen. It was exactly a kind of an old cafeteria-style kitchen. So we've got all the equipment we need. It's not very big. We can only teach 8 medical students at a time. This year, we have done a lot in the last 9 months since we got this project off the ground. We've created a curriculum for our first and second year medical students. It's an 8-course curriculum. The med students come in, there's a small lecture, a didactic component, and then a hands-on cooking class that reflects whatever that topic might be. It might be on, you know, changing sodium content in food and recipes. It might be about high fiber. It might be about carbohydrates, healthy fats, making snacks, etc. And the emphasis that we've tried to create in this curriculum is on that communication piece with your patient. How do you talk to folks about this in making changes, small, simple changes that don't interfere with eating great food, which is important to you and me, but creating a dialogue that they can have with their patients. And then after the cooking, the hands-on cooking, they divide up into teams. Each of them does a different recipe. Each team does a different recipe. They sit down at the end and have a family-style meal and tasting. And we have kind of exercises there that might be translating the nutrition information from the basic sciences to their board-style questions, because they still have to pass the national boards. Or it may be a discussion of a particular case history on a patient and how would you work with this patient. We've had patients come in and talk to our students about their weight loss, their eating healthier, their improvement in their health, et cetera. So it's been a really exciting time creating that curriculum. At the same time, we've been very active working in the community as well.
And what are some of the changes that you've observed in the students who are participating in this program?
That's a great question. Obviously, one of the things we want to show, you know, we're physicians and nutritionists as well as chefs working in this program. We want to show good outcomes. That's one of the things that's very important to us in medicine as well as medical education today. Have you had an impact, and what impact? So I can't tell you right now. We surveyed our students at the beginning of the year. We had a tremendous response to a survey of our first, second, third, and fourth year medical students. And we'll rerun that survey at the end of this year. We won't have as big a footprint this year because we've only been able to teach so far. We've taught about 50 of the second-year medical students, which is about a third of the class, a quarter of the class. We'll do about the same with the first-year medical students in the spring semester this year. We have some other projects going on where we offer seminars, one-hour disease-related seminars, like how do you think about food and hypertension? How do you think about food and diabetes? How do you have those conversations with your patients for our fourth-year medical students? And then starting next month, we'll have about 15 of our medical students go to Johnson & Wales, and they'll do a month-long rotation with the culinary nutrition program. They'll spend time just as if they were going to culinary school, but in the culinary nutrition program, going to class in the morning and going to the labs or the kitchens in the afternoon, hands-on cooking in the afternoon. And then on Fridays, they'll spend time with dietitians at the Rhode Island Hospital.
And how long are they going to be up there doing that?
They'll be there for 4 weeks.
Wow, that seems like a big chunk out of medical school time to me.
Well, you know, medical students get elective rotations. They're month-long rotations, and they get a number of electives that they can use and are encouraged to pursue things that they think will have an impact on their chosen specialty. Although, so far, we have found that this is not really specialty specific. You would think, oh, pediatricians or family medicine doctors or primary care physicians, but we have students who are going to be anesthesiologists and orthopedists. So it's been kind of interesting how we have not been really specialty specific. I will tell you that all of these classes were really limited on our capacity right now. Once our teaching kitchen is open, we would and will be able to teach every medical student who wants to come and take the elective. Our first and second year medical student class, the first one we ran, sold out in about 30 minutes. I mean, so we've got an amazing interest in these classes with the med students. More importantly, I think, for New Orleans and the New Orleans community is these cooking classes that we're going to be and are doing at the Fertel Community Clinic.
This is part of your community outreach.
This is the community outreach piece. And last year, we set a goal of recruiting about 35 new freshmen, new first-year medical students this year. We had about 15 of our second-year medical students, and we figured we'd have about 50 students. That's a pretty nice little army, if you will, to go out and teach nutrition, talk about eating healthy, doing cooking classes, et cetera. We had 122 students sign up.
Wow.
So we've had this amazing interest in the community piece, and these classes are now being taught at the Fertel Community Clinic as well as at Keller. So it's not just about us being in this teaching kitchen in the community, but it's also the outreach that the students can do.
And how can listeners learn about these community opportunities?
They can go to Facebook. We have a Facebook page, which is the TUSOM Kitchen, TUSOM, Tulane University School of Medicine Teaching Kitchen. Or they could send me an email at tharlan@tulane.edu, and I can point them in the right direction for whatever they need as far as signing up for classes. And again, those classes, our goal is we're teaching our medical students, and the Johnson & Wales interns are here helping teach the culinary skills. We're working on teaching the medical students the nutrition skills so they can teach the community. And that becomes the force multiplier for us. Our goal for the next academic year that'll start in July is we'll be teaching at least one cooking class. And I actually probably think as many as two cooking classes every single day somewhere in New Orleans.
You really are changing the way New Orleans eats, one bite at a time, huh?
We hope so, but we don't want to change really the way they eat or what they eat. We still want folks to eat great food. We just want to tweak it a little bit, enough to reduce a little bit of the sodium, reduce a little bit of the calories, but not reduce any of that great flavor.
Well, I want to thank you for keeping us up to date on this, and promise next time, bring some students with you.
I'll bring some students, and I'll also bring our chef, Chef Leah Saris. She has done a fantastic job helping create this curriculum. It's been pretty amazing.
See you soon.
Looking forward to it.
Dr. Gourmet, Tulane University's medical director, Tim Harlan.
Can you feel it?
That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan and Company, Lights Egan Funeral Homes, and our media sponsor, Louisiana Kitchen and Culture Magazine. Theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes, produced at Piety Street Recording. Thanks to producer and sound engineer Thomas Walsh and our editor, Zoe Sullivan. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO.